This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with former Louisiana Governor Edwin Washington Edwards. He turned 85 years old this week. He spent one-tenth of his life in federal prison, was released last year, married a woman 52 years his junior, the beautiful Trina Edwards, and they are planning on having a baby. We will talk with Edwin Edwards about his remarkable life in politics and how long does he think he will live. We'll find out from the former governor. Also, Maria Gudovich, her book is Soldier Dogs, about the amazing military dogs being used in Afghanistan. And President Peggy Polk of Project Purr, one of the fine cat organizations saving felines in our city. All this today, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest at this time is former Governor Edwin Washington Edwards. For four terms, he served the state of Louisiana in the highest capacity, 26 elections in his career, 25 victories in primaries and general elections. He was with us a year ago, and we're glad you're back. Good morning, Governor Edwards.
Well, I'm a year older, so I guess it was appropriate that I come back.
Well, you've gotten married last time you were here, and that was Trina in, being your fiance, and I see you have your beautiful wife with you, and thank you for bringing Trina with you, and you don't go many places without her.
Oh, yeah, I know, and much to the consternation of Trina's many admirers, we're still together.
Well, Governor Edwards, you spent 3,000 days and change behind bars, and you've had a great life. But it was one that was interrupted for 8.5 years. And we talked last year as you were immediately released from prison. This was one of your first stops. Do you think much about those years now, or is that a distant memory?
I've been remarkably busy since I got out. Frankly, I've been to every major city and most of the moderate-sized cities in Louisiana in speech-making and touring on for book sales. People have been unbelievably cordial and gracious and accepting of my situation, and I cannot explain to anybody how good it makes me feel, because all during the time I was in prison, I naturally wondered what kind of reaction I'd get from people in Louisiana when I got out, and it just exceeds my wildest dreams. I just frankly cannot express how grateful I am.
Did it disappoint you that you were not able to run this last election?
Yes and no. It disappointed me in that, like an old fire horse, I wanted to go to the polls. But on the other hand, I'm practical enough to realize that I probably would have got elected, and then I'd have all these problems that the present administration has imposed on the state. And while I would be willing to wrestle with them, and I think I could help to work them out, it nevertheless is a daunting task, and I feel comfortable that I don't have the responsibility, although I wish somebody would step up to the plate and do something about what's happening in Louisiana.
Well, are you disappointed in the performance of the current governor? What's your analysis of Bobby Jindal?
I just don't understand how he can justify spending the majority of his time in other states. When I was governor, I just wanted to be governor of Louisiana. He seems to be want to be governor of every state but Louisiana. But that's his decision. And up until now, the people have tolerated, and who knows, maybe we'll get lucky and he'll be nominated to some position in Washington, and he'll do something no other politician has ever done. He'll make his friends happy and his enemies happier.
He is an ambitious young man. He was born in 1971, the year that you won your first election for governor. So I'm sure whether he would acknowledge it or not, he was influenced by you. What do you think about how the evolution of politics has changed the landscape in which now the state is largely Republican? When you were a politician, it was almost impossible to get elected unless you were a Democrat.
That's true, and it's an enigma that I don't understand. But from Texas to Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, all of these southern tier states have become Republican states. When I was in Congress, we did not have a Democratic member of Congress. Now they all except one Senate and one congressman. It's difficult to understand. I think I can perceive the reasons for it, but on the other hand, exercising my ability as a soothsayer, I'm going to say when people begin to get the impact of these Republican policies, which starve out the middle class and the working classes, the pendulum is going to swing in the other direction. I don't know whether I'll live long enough to witness it, but you will.
Well, Governor, you've commented that the way you were raised, son of a sharecropper, a young man without means, and seeing the discrimination against people of color in your day, that influenced your later political philosophy. How so?
I'm definitely a liberal insofar as doing things for people. I have a great concern for the disadvantaged, the poor, the disabled, for elderly people. And I think that government, in my philosophy, owes them an opportunity to make better lives for themselves. I just don't think it's right in this country, in this day and age, for anyone's child to suffer without medical care when he or she is in pain, life-threatening or just simple, serious pain. Life is too short, and we're too compassionate a nation and a too compassionate people to allow that to happen. And this business of our present governor saying he's not going to use the funds available from the federal government to take care of the health needs of 400,000 to 500,000 elderly people and sick children at government expense, not at his expense, not at Louisiana's expenses, but at the national government's expense. We're missing a great opportunity to be more compassionate for the disadvantaged people in Louisiana and the poor. You know, not only health care, but he turned down an $80 million grant to bring internet service to the rural areas, schools, libraries, police stations, and individuals throughout the rural part of the state. Again, the money was turned down by him. We lost the benefits of it. Some other state got it. What did he accomplish?
In Louisiana, we become a flaming red state as far as our political philosophy and voting patterns. We become solidly Republican. Listening to you, you still have the Democratic Party and its goals and aspirations at your heart or in your heart. Why has it changed so much in the last 20 years? 20 years ago, you won a landslide, or 21 years ago, for governor, and every other elected official who was a Democrat won except for the race for Secretary of State. Why have we gone from one extreme to another in two decades?
Well, it's something that happened through the years, and in large part it is due to the fact that because of legitimate, compassionate policies from the national government and the state government, people got much of what they needed and decided they didn't need government anymore and decided to move into a more conservative aspect. But I talked to people, for instance, in St. Tammany area, where they're losing their mental hospital that's been there for 60 years. 300 people are going to be out of work. I don't know what they're going to do with the mentally deranged people that are in there. That parish has the highest suicide rate in the state, and yet the present administration is closing the hospital there. There's got to be some reason for that kind of attitude towards the needs of people. Now, my point is this. We had all those good things. We had the only statewide charity hospital system in the country, many of which I built, and it's going back to Huey Long's days. Well, people got complacent. They had it, so they didn't need government. So they began to listen to people who talked about conservative government, balancing the budget, although they haven't balanced the budget since I left town. But nevertheless, they have now substituted social needs, which they had fulfilled, for what they consider to be conservative government. But I predict that when the results of that kind of government is evidenced, that people will change their minds, because in this day and age, people have gotten used to assistance, education, health care from government, and it needs to be continued.
Well, you were 8 years old when Huey Long died. Do you remember much about him from your youth, the kingfish?
No, he died when I was very young. I was assassinated when I was very young. I knew a great deal more about his brother Earl, but my father, you know, like most poor dirt farmers in the state, appreciated Huey Long's efforts to bring school books and better roads and privileges for the poor and the disadvantaged.
Well, you have seen all the great figures of the 20th century in your career, either as a public official or a follower of politics. Who stands out on the national scene? Which presidents have impressed you?
Of course, I was a great admirer of Jack Kennedy because of his attitude towards minorities and the desire to give the promise of America to all people in America. But the politician and the figure that I admired the most as a president was Lyndon Johnson for two reasons. Number one, I was the first member of Congress elected after he was elected to a full term. I beat the man who had been Goldwater's campaign manager in our area. So he was very pleased with that. And so I got to be good friends with Barefoot Sanders, who was then his number one man, and got to know Lyndon Johnson very well. And when the rice farmers in my area got in serious trouble because of a proposed change in agricultural policies that were relating to the rice industry, I went to the President of the United States as a member of Congress and brought with me other members of Congress who from rice areas, and we persuaded him to leave the program as it was. And I can tell you, and people in Southwest Louisiana will tell you, it saved the rice industry as we know it. And my point is this. Lyndon Johnson was the kind of fellow who used power to get things done. And I think that's what politicians should do. Hopefully, we will use the power to do it for proper persons' purposes, but at least don't sit on it and let the country waffle and wave while nothing is happening. Get something done. Make things happen. Move.
Now, in your last term as governor, the governor of Arkansas at the start was Bill Clinton. One of the first endorsements he received was from you. What was your perception of him?
He was another person who I thought was a politician. And, you know, some people don't like the word politician, but politician simply means of the people, for the people. And if you're going to be in politics, you shouldn't be ashamed to say you're a politician, because that's what you are in that capacity in your life. And Bill Clinton was wise enough after his initial forays into his plans to begin to move to the center of the political spectrum and to work with Congress and to get things done. And of course, those of us who have that attitude don't always get our way. We don't always succeed in doing what we wish done, but at least we get something accomplished and there is movement rather than stagnation.
What's your perception of the race that is ahead between President Obama and Mitt Romney as they head into the home stretch? How do you see the 2012 election?
Given the condition of the economy, and I'm quick to point out that the worst part of the economy occurred before Obama became president. I think one of the reasons that he had a landslide victory was because things were so bad. And I think it's to his credit that to some extent it has been moderated, but we're still in serious financial trouble. Now, having said that, it's hard for me to understand how he can maintain the measure of popularity that the polls show he has. And that may save him. But let me tell you something. If so, he'll be a miracle worker, because he'll be the only president in modern times who was able to get reelected with the debt this country has, and the high rate of unemployment.
We'll be back after this one-minute timeout with former Louisiana Governor Edwin Washington Edwards. He was elected four times as the chief executive of our state, 1971, 1975, 1983, and 1991. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Former Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards is with us. 16 years he was leader of our state as governor from 1971 until he left office in 1996. And before that quarter century, he also served as a council member in Crowley. He served in the Louisiana Senate and was a U.S. congressman in the 7th District from 1965 to 1972. Edwin Washington Edwards, his life is detailed in all its glory, including the setbacks, by Leo Honeycutt in his celebrated biography of Edwin Washington Edwards, released in December of 2009. And now, according to his publisher, Jim Brown, the most bought book in the history of Louisiana publishing. Many people are fascinated about the life and times of Edwin Edwards. And I'm sure, Leo, that this even surprises you, the enduring popularity and interest in the former governor.
Well, it absolutely does, and I feel very, very, very fortunate to have been the one that did it. And it's interesting that I didn't want to do it in the beginning, as we've talked about a few times, but I'm glad that I got tapped to do it, because I really wanted to prove to myself, you know, was this guy a crook or not? And, of course, he's going to strangle me now since we're so close here. Governor! No. We had some times back then, and we don't – nowadays we're so concerned about mostly monetary issues, and we should be in this country as well as in the state. But when you go back and you look at the 1960s and you relive the 60s and 70s, but especially the 60s, you realize what a violent time that was. With the Kennedy assassinations, Martin Luther King's assassination, the shooting of George Wallace. I mean, it was an amazing time. It was an amazing how much we actually put up with as a people. And we got embroiled in Vietnam, and then Vietnam led to Watergate. So it's, you know, we had the Arab oil embargoes then. We saw gasoline shoot from 28 cents a gallon up to over a dollar a gallon. So it was a very times there changed tremendously and very rapidly, and that's when Edwin Edwards came to power. Came out of a situation where you had John McKithen, who is a very progressive governor, reform governor. That's what he called himself, and then he left a $30 million deficit, the largest in state history at that time, and it's funny because when you go back and you see the campaigns, and the governor here had 17 other opponents in that 1971 election, and John McKithen came out and he said, "I don't know what all these guys are talking about. We reformed everything that could be reformed."
Well, at the time he had, but there were new challenges and new opportunities as we went from the 70s to the 80s. Not the least of which is writing a new constitution, mm-hmm. which had been long delayed. And not the least of which was changing the method by which we collect severance taxes on oil and gas, which brought billions of dollars into the state, paid for mostly by people in the Northeast using our natural resources at regulated prices. Those are just two things, you know, and people like to talk about me, and I know people have some reservations about me, and I understand that. But in opposition to the allegations that I stole money from the state, let me tell you that in 1986, I wrestled out of the federal government a $640 million settlement on a long-standing Tidelands oil controversy. Didn't put the money in my pocket, didn't give it to my friends, as you hear some people say, but put $100 million in a one-time pay raise for teachers, school bus drivers, and lunchroom workers, took $540 million and put it in a specially dedicated fund for education. And since that time, the colleges and universities have enjoyed a $40 to $60 million annual windfall to use for enrichment programs, for getting better professors, or for whatever use the campuses thought was proper. That fund, because of the plans that we made, has escalated to where today it's worth $1 billion, which with a B, $200 million, that's with an M, dollars. It's in the bank. We are the only state in the nation that has such a fund, and I am the only governor who ever left a legacy for the people of the state. Everybody else either left the cupboard bare or left it bare with a load of groceries to still buy with heavy debt.
When you were governor in your third term, you engineered the sale of the Saints to Tom Benson, who has held the team since 1986. What's your take about the importance of the Saints staying in New Orleans? They were probably close at several points, in particular when in your third term, from moving out of Louisiana and going elsewhere.
Among other things, I had to go into New Orleans and save the World's Fair, which was scheduled there, in spite of the bad publicity we got from the now extinct Times-Picayune about how horrible the fair was and this was going to happen, that was going to happen. As a result of that negative publicity, people all over the world were canceling their reservations to come to the fair. It was threatened to be closed, and I managed to put up the money to save it. In addition to that, although John McKithen was the father of the Superdome, I had to rock the baby, because when I became governor, the first bond had not been sold, the first lump of dirt had not been moved. I built the stadium, okay, and I'm glad I did. But in addition to that, when there was an effort made to move the Saints football team out of the city, I took a great deal of criticism, because I prevailed upon the legislature to do what was necessary to keep it. Now, my severest critics don't ever say anything about it, but they're all happy that the Saints are there.
Well, during that term, the third one, you were on trial a couple of times. You were a hung jury first time, although the vote was heavily in favor of acquittal, and then the prosecutor, John Volz, tried again and failed, and this time there was an acquittal, a unanimous verdict from the jury. Did that leave any scars?
No, it made me realize the power of the federal government. They have unlimited money, unlimited resources, and unlimited time, and they will wear anybody down. They tried me 4 times during my career, tried to do it another 20 times, but just couldn't get anything going. 3 of the times when I had a fair judge who was not doing what he could to help the prosecution, they didn't succeed at all. They finally did by allowing former friends of mine to make millions of dollars and keep it, even though what they said was that we had done something illegal. They got the money, and I got the prison term.
Did you ever think you would outlive the Times-Picayune?
No, I didn't, because it was the only paper in town. And in spite of the fact that they rarely, if ever, supported New Orleans or the state, they were always very critical. They almost caused the closing of the Superdome. I had to call a meeting with them, with the editors of the media in New Orleans, and tell them in so many words, if they didn't quit publishing negative stories about the Superdome, I would not ask the legislature to generate the money needed to keep it open. They were so negative about it. They had people believing they'd get raped and held up and mugged if they went to the dome, and that just wasn't so. I was endorsed 3 times by the Times-Picayune. But the moment I took office, they spent all that time, energy, and effort trying to denigrate my efforts and to try to... It was nothing but negative publicity. I can understand an editorial writer who doesn't have his mental capacities, and many of them do not, writing editorials about what's happening in the state. That's his privilege. But when you move that into the news columns and color and distort the news based upon the ideology of the publisher and editors of a newspaper, then that is not doing the public any good or any service.
Edwin Washington Edwards is with us, with his biographer, Leo Honeycutt. He won 4 elections for governor of Louisiana. No man has ever won more than twice, although Earl Long did serve part of 3 terms. And Edwin Washington Edwards had 16 years on the grand stage. You say you never thought about running for president of the United States.
No. When Teddy Kennedy was going to be a candidate, he and I talked about my position as a vice presidential candidate. But his accident squashed whatever plans he had for that, and of course, so did I. Other than that, though, I really like Louisiana. I like being governor. I like doing things for people who, before my time, had no one to help them or to no one to be responsible for them or no one who seemed to care about them. As I travel around the state now, that's the one recurring theme I get from people. I cared about people, and I did. And more important, I cared about people who needed somebody to care about them.
When you won your last election in 1991, you beat David Duke in 1991. What would the state have looked like if David Duke had won that election?
I think it would have been a very detrimental effect insofar as attracting industry and tourism and development in the state. I think it would have set the stage for some very, very serious race problems.
But Duke got a majority of the white votes in two elections, in 91 and for governor and in 1990 for the U.S. Senate. How do you explain that? A guy who was a grand wizard of the Klan, had Nazi tendencies, and yet almost 700,000 people voted for him.
There were then and probably now people in Louisiana who just didn't like black folks. And he had them believing that if he got elected, he'd send all the black folks to Africa. Well, we all know that wasn't going to happen. Also, this state, like most southern states, had a disdain for the federal government. And he capitalized on that to his credit. You know, I saw a fellow on TV during that campaign. Of course, the press was anxious to try to stir up controversy between me and David. They had this old fella from North Louisiana somewhere talking about how he was for David Duke. Well, why? Well, the reason is I'm tired of all these government giveaway programs. It's time we settle down and talking on and on. Come to find out he was on food stamps and welfare. Well, when the reporter hit him with that, he said, well, yes, but when all those other people are put on it like Edwards wants to do, then I won't get as much. I guess that's a human attitude, but it hardly really is compassionate.
Now, you've outlived many of your enemies, but you've also outlived many of your friends. When people like Victor Busey and Sammy Nunez die, what does that do to you?
I didn't have two better friends than Victor Busey and Sammy Nunez. When I was in prison, 25 close friends died, including my only sister and my oldest brother. I was managed to get to my sister's funeral, but the rest of them passed into the next world without me being able to say a last goodbye. In Harry Lee's case, they allowed me to make a taped expression of my sympathy and my regrets, which they played at his funeral. And I appreciated that very much because he was as good a friend as I've ever had. And it's true. As you get older, that is one of the prices one pays. Your family, your friends, those you love and respect begin to pass into the next world. It's just part of the price of growing old. However, I can tell you right now, in spite of the fact that that's a heavy burden, I'm still glad I'm 85 years old.
Well, last time we spoke a year ago on this show, you made some statements, and I got a lot of the reaction after the program asking me if Edwin Edwards was a believer or a non-believer. Would you characterize yourself as one who believes in God or one who is doubtful or not believe at all?
I don't believe in God as most people conceive of God. I really don't want to get into that, but I have my own version of what life and the hereafter is about. I'll only close by saying this. I have no fear at all of dying. I hate like hell to give up living because for me, life has been very pleasant. But I don't worry about dying at all. Never have.
Through your life, you have always been attracted to beautiful women, and this is evident by the lovely lady who's your wife, and they have been attracted to you. Does it bother you that that will be a big part of your legacy?
No, because I'm a politician and a Cajun. We are people who are compassionate. We're also very friendly. I got that from my mother, who loved everybody and did whatever people wanted to do to help them. I inherited that spirit from her, and I'm glad I did. Now, unlike most politicians who get in trouble with women, our national senator being one of them, you never had any scandal about me and women in the press or the newspapers. I never was assaulted by anybody. I never was accused of spending my time in houses of ill repute. No one ever attacked me for having been involved with a woman. No woman ever came forward and said I had disrespected her, because I didn't. What I did do was to make everybody believe that I really was his or her friend, and that I wanted to be his or her friend. And some people interpreted that more deeply than I meant it, and I understand that, but it's the way I am. Now, believe me, a long time ago, when I got out of politics in 1996, I made up my mind that while I would continue to be friendly with everybody and do what I can to be helpful, and I have been, in spite of the fact that I have not been in politics all these years, I would do everything I could to avoid the appearance of having an interest in anyone except the woman I'm now married to. And believe me, it's a better way to live.
At what point in your life, Governor, did you say, I want to be governor? Was it at 3 years old, at 30 years old? When did it happen?
It probably was the first 8 words that I said. But I can remember when I was in high school telling my friends, much to their ridiculing, that's what I intended to be. There were a number of reasons. No South Louisiana Cajun had been governor in modern times, and there was a prevailing philosophy that it was impossible to be governor if you were Cajun and from South Louisiana. And I viewed that as a challenge. And also, I became a lawyer because I wanted to be helpful to people, and I got in politics for the same reason. I would have been a very wealthy man had I stayed as a practicing lawyer rather than getting involved in politics, but I would not have been as productive or made a contribution to my state and nation or to humanity in general had I done that. And I'm glad I did what I did in spite of the price that I paid for it, and it was a price. But I console myself knowing that many, many people out there who've never met me, never shook my hand, never saw my face, have a better life because Edwin Edwards was here in the 70s and 80s.
As we close, how long do you think you will live?
I'll live another 15 years. I'll make 100. You'll have me on your radio show next 15 years. As a matter of fact, I'll make a bargain with you. If you last as long as I do, and you probably won't, I'll come every year after my birthday, and I'll allow you to interview me.
That's a deal.
That's a deal.
Well, thank you, Governor.
So you can tell your producer, look, if you leave me where I am, in spite of my disabilities and my lack of abilities, I have a guaranteed first-class interviewee for the next 15 years.
I tell you, I know what I'll be doing in 2027.
And during that time, while you collect your check, maybe you'll remember that I'm in part responsible for it.
Well, God bless you. Edwin Edwards, thank you.
All right. You're a good fella, Jim.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Maria Gudovich. Her book is Soldier Dogs, When Members of Navy SEAL Team 6 Raided Osama Bin Laden's Compound in the now famous, infamous night last spring. They didn't go in alone. They were joined by Cairo. Now, that is the topic of our discussion. Good morning to you, Maria Gudovich. Tell us about Cairo.
Cairo is a Belgian Malinois. Belgian Malinois are a very popular breed in the military these days. They look a little like a German Shepherd, except they're a little more lithe and lean and not quite so furry, a little more pointy. And this dog, we don't know exactly what he did with the Navy SEALs because they're not really talking about the raid. I tried for months to get some more information, but probably he went in before the SEALs, with one of the SEALs and right ahead of them for sniffing out for explosives at the doorways or sniffing for people behind, hidden in places. We don't know exactly what, because dogs have such a wide variety of capabilities in this kind of use, so we can only conjecture at this point. But it was undoubtedly something very important.
Veteran journalist Maria Gudavage is with us, an editor and featured writer at the popular website Dogster. She goes behind the gated government facilities to discover the untold stories of military working dogs and handlers across all four services. Now, could this mission to kill bin Laden, could it have been accomplished without the presence of Cairo?
Because we don't know exactly what Cairo did, we can't say that for sure. But if they felt a need to bring a dog along, there was obviously something really important for that dog to do. And perhaps there weren't explosives behind the door or attached to certain doorways or rooms, and maybe they didn't need the dog. But there was a reason for that, and I'm sure the SEALs felt a lot more comfortable with the dog at their side or leading the way if that's indeed what Cairo did.
What is so special about this Belgian Malinois?
Well, the Belgian Malinois are much more resilient in many ways than a German Shepherd. German Shepherds are incredible. They're smart. They're just, as you know, through the ages, we've just revered these German Shepherds, and for very good reason. But Belgian Malinois have fewer hip problems. They're not as prone to arthritis earlier in life as well. And they just keep on going, and just they're a little bit better in the heat. Although anyone is vulnerable to the heat we have in Afghanistan in the summertime especially. But it's just a dog that's really resilient and will, unfortunately, they will work till they drop. So the handlers have to be really aware. Like a German Shepherd might say, hey, you know, hey, guy, it's just getting a little hot here. Let's take a break in their body language. The Malinois, they're just driven, and they will just keep on going.
How big is the Malinois?
Belgian Malinois, they vary greatly in size from about, I met one who was only about 45 pounds, and they can go up to, you know, 60, 70 pounds, depending. But they're a lot easier to carry over your shoulder if you're going over fields. The great fields have in Afghanistan, where a lot of these soldier dogs are, they have walls you have to climb, and you might have to put your dog on your shoulder, or if your dog's injured, you have to carry your dog over your shoulder as well as all your 80 pounds of gear. So they're a lot lighter.
Are they by nature fierce animals?
No, by nature, absolutely not. They are bred in Europe. The ones that the DOD acquires, the Department of Defense acquires, are bred in Europe, and they're brought over when they're about 2 years old, and they're trained to, some of them just become sniffer dogs, so they're just out there sniffing for IEDs, which is, of course, dogs' most important role in Afghanistan right now, to sniff out the IEDs before the troops sniff them as a step on them, and they save so many lives. But the dogs are incredibly good companions, and they will attack when needed if they're trained for that kind of role. They'll protect and attack, and they love the bite. They're not called Maligators for no reason. And actually, the Department of Defense has its own breeding program for these dogs. It's just really getting rolling pretty successfully right now. Their goal is to breed about 100 viable Malinois soldier dogs each year, and to have those puppies each year. And they're looking for homes for those dogs if you're living around the San Antonio area. I know most of your listeners aren't, but you can foster one of these little Malinois puppies for about 7 months.
Maria Gudavage, he is the author of Soldier Dogs. It goes into depth about the takeout of Osama bin Laden. Navy SEAL Team 6 got most of the credit for the raid, and justifiably so, but perhaps the raid would not have been successful without the presence of Cairo, the Belgian Malinois. How long does it take to train an animal like this for a mission of this kind?
Well, in general, the dogs are brought back from Europe when they're about 2 years old. They've already had some training, and then they go into special training at Lackland Air Force Base, which is the sort of ground zero for dog training. And they take, it depends on the dog's job, but it can be several months, 4 or 5 months. And if they have more specialized jobs, even longer. Those jobs for the Navy SEALs dogs, though, they're taken care of by contractors. So their training goes through contractors as opposed to the vast majority of the military dogs in use now goes through the Lackland Air Force Base trainers. And they're trained in a number of capabilities. Many sniff out bombs, some sniff out drugs, some can attack and defend. Some can even track. You have bombs, but you have someone who places the bomb, the IED. They can track the person who places that, so they're sniffing trails. They're mine detectors, and they're companions too. They're not trained to be companions, but that's a really important role over in war. Is that these guys are just their best friends, and they're right there for the troops, and they offer a lot of morale boosting. It's not why they're there, but it's a huge fringe benefit.
In the takeout of bin Laden, was there more than one Belgian Malinois, or was it just Cairo?
Just Cairo. As far as we know, Cairo is the only dog we've heard about so far. And the dogs, they're called the dogs that go along with these special ops and things like Navy SEALs, they're very they have a lot of the same skills that the everyday working dog has, and they've got some extra skills on the side, but they're generally similar dogs. They may pay a little more money for them and work a little harder with them, but so far we only know about one Belgian Malinois.
Now, there were reports that Cairo was wearing a bulletproof vest. Is there anything to this?
It could well be, but the thing is about bulletproof vests, they're kind of heavy. And depending on, it can impair movement. But I have a feeling that a dog with such value as one might have in Cairo would probably be wearing some kind of a bulletproof material over him. And there were reports that the dog was also wearing infrared cameras, night vision goggles, and had titanium teeth. And a lot of these are a little bit overblown. A dog has good night vision, and it really doesn't do any good to. And a dog really is all about the nose and not so much about the vision. So that, and the titanium teeth. Hey, no self-respecting veterinarian is going to pull out a dog's teeth and put titanium teeth in his place. Sometimes they do get teeth replacements if they do break a teeth, and they may be titanium. But there was a lot of fun, interesting stuff bandied about the Cairo, because there were no hard facts given. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, thank you, Maria Gudavage. Her book is Soldier Dogs, and it is a compelling story about the unsung hero of the raid to kill bin Laden, Cairo, the Belgian Malinois. Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. Our guest at this time is Dr. Peggy Polk, president of Project PER. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Okay, President Peggy Polk of Project PER, how are things going? 2 years, an anniversary that you're celebrating.
Well, we are kind of celebrating an anniversary. Over the past 2 years, we've saved over 1,700 lives from our community shelter, the CAA shelter, and we're celebrating just slightly over 1,400 adoptions of all those animals at this point, too.
And how significant is the challenge in Baton Rouge regarding cats that are out on the streets looking for homes?
Great question. The challenge is tremendous. We, by Humane Society of the United States estimates, we have over 60,000 homeless cats in our community. Now, the vast majority of those are feral cats, which is just really just wildlife. Feral cats are wildlife. But the problem that presents is that those feral cats are reproducing like crazy. Our breeding period down here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is almost all year long because of our nice warm climate. So they're pumping out kittens right and left, and a lot of those kittens wind up at our community shelter, CAA, and then it behooves all of us as a community to try and save those lives rather than have to put them down because of lack of space.
And of those 1,700 you're talking about, many were rescued from so-called death row.
We exclusively rescue from death row. That's it. I mean, that's the only reason we exist, is to lower the kill rate at our community shelter.
I thought we had a no-kill policy in place.
Yes. Okay, so no-kill is a term that gets misused and overused. any organization can be no-kill. All you have to do is just say, okay, we're going to stop taking in animals when we run out of space. And so, for instance, Project PER is no-kill because when we run out of foster homes, we just stop admitting. An open admissions pound facility like CAA, they don't have the option of stopping admissions. When people from the public bring in cats or when there's a complaint and animal control officers bring an animal in, CAA can't say, sorry, we're out of room. They have to take them in. Mm-hmm. And so the effort of no-kill involves a multifaceted approach, including programs which decrease admissions to the shelter and programs which move animals out of the shelter more quickly. The programs which decrease admissions include low-cost, high-volume spay-neuter, trap-neuter return of the 60,000 feral cats, and also counseling people on options to not have to surrender their animal to the shelter. Like maybe if there's a behavioral problem or a medical problem, the shelter can help them with those so that they don't have to surrender to the shelter. And then programs which increase movement out of the shelter would mean a robust adoption program, and programs like Project PER and Yelp, which specifically target those animals, moving them into a rescue organization. Okay. So rescue organizations are a big piece of that.
So even though we have a stated no-kill policy, there are some animals, cats and dogs and others, who are being killed.
Yeah, it's not really a policy, Jim. It's an effort, and those efforts take time. You can't just stop killing, because when you stop killing, then you're hoarding, basically. I mean, an open admission shelter that just stops killing, you're going to have to stack those animals up one on top of the other. And if you don't have the staffing to take care of them, which you don't, we don't, then you're just becoming a hoarder. So it's a process, and it involves the entire community. It involves support from the city. It's a multifaceted approach. So it's not really a philosophy. Okay. It's a process.
You mentioned one other organization. There are several organizations dedicated to cats in Baton Rouge. How does Project PER work in conjunction or independently from those others?
Yeah, we're independent of the others. What we do is specifically target cats who are at risk of being euthanized at CAA. So they only come from CAA. We do not rescue from the public. We have a lot of great rescue organizations, Cat Haven, Cause, Save Our Strays, APAWS. All of those organizations take in from the community, homeless cats from the community. So we let them do their great work, and we focus specifically on death row.
Well, a few years ago when your organization first began, you were on this program, and you asked me if I would be interested in adopting a cat, and I did. And then you said, how about another one? And I got two at the same time, two for the price of one, literally.
Boom.
But you're telling me those cats were on death row?
They were on death row.
Wow.
Yeah, you saved their lives. You saved not only those two lives, but you saved the lives of two other animals who can now come in and occupy those spaces.
Well, that's interesting. How close were they to being put down?
At that time, that was before CAA assumed responsibility for the shelter side of animal control. At that time, there was a 6-day hold, or it might have even been 7 days. I can't remember. But once that hold period was up, pretty much,
that's the end of the
line.
They
were put down unless there was somebody that was willing to take them.
And these were newborn cats, too, who have now blossomed into fine animals.
There you go.
So there you go. So it's a worthy cause, and I guess the sobering thing is that no matter how much you do, we're still going to have a challenge.
It's always going to be a challenge. It's always going to be an ongoing effort that's going to require a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of passion, and a lot of funding.
How many cats do you have, President Peggy Polk of Project PER?
We have a feral cat population that roams our neighborhood that we trap. We trapped and neutered and returned to colony. So, but I don't really count those. They kind of are owned by our whole neighborhood, but we help feed them. So I don't count those, but we have 8 indoor only cats.
8 cats.
Mm-hmm. But we have a 5,500 square foot house, and they're our children. We don't have kids. So those are our children.
So to paraphrase Piers Morgan, how many times have you been properly in love?
With what?
I guess one of your cats.
Eight
times.
Eight times. That's a lot of loving.
And my husband is the love of my life. I love you, Steve.
Let's hope so. But this is a community which has gotten involved in this endeavor quite earnestly, and that's impressive.
Mm-hmm. And we try and have a lot of adoption specials to promote adoptions, because obviously the more people that adopt from us, the more we can go back to the shelter and save. So this month we're having a happy hour every Friday. And so every Friday at Mall of Louisiana at our kiosk, we're knocking $20 off adoption fees of any pet that you want to adopt.
Happy hour. What's the happy hour?
It's just you're going to go home happy with your new cat.
No, but is there a particular time to
5:30 to 8.
5:30 to 8. So that's a happy 2.5 hours.
It's a exactly.
But I'm sure you're enthused, and many people walk away with big smiles on their faces.
Yes.
And I'm sure the cats are smiling,
as
too.
As do we.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for what you do, and this is something, you're in this line of work, many in your world, they would not get involved. What propelled you into this?
I've always loved animals, and when I learned that we in Baton Rouge were killing so many dogs and cats, I couldn't take it. I just had to do something, and luckily I was associated with other people who felt as I do, and so we just decided to organize. It coalesced as the no-kill steering committee, actually driven by Baton Rouge Area Foundation. So this we have Baton Rouge Area Foundation to thank for really getting this all
and
started.
And for those who want more information about Project PER,
www.projectperbr.org.
Well, thank you. President Peggy Polk of Project PER. Congratulations on 2 years.
Thank you, Jim Engster, adopter of Project PER Kitties.
And for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.